There's no doubt that people who live near fracking sites experience health problems.
It's easy to make the blame game. If your kids are sick or your grandparents are sick or you're not feeling so well yourself, to say, ah, it must be that well pack.
But it might be more complicated than that. I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, a researcher's new theory about pollution and the fracking industry. Plus, while the Trump administration champions fossil fuels, the solar industry continues to boom.
We've grown 100% the last 3 years running. I don't know if we can keep that up. It's it's causing me to get a lot of gray hair.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A lot of us got out our fans or switched on the AC this week. There have already been some real scorchers this year, and it's not even officially summer yet. Climate change will bring longer, hotter heat waves to Pennsylvania, according to experts. And some are worried how those living without air conditioning will adjust. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports that the future may bring subsidized cooling to low-income residents.
2016 was the hottest year on record. It broke the heat record set in 2015, which broke the record set in 2014. Climate scientists say it's only going to get worse. With President Trump pulling out of the Global Climate Agreement, there's a new push to get cities and states to pick up the slack, and they might also have to pick up the tab. Pennsylvania Public Utility Commissioner David Sweet says the impact of a warmer climate will put lives at risk across the state.
Particularly elderly are in homes. They perhaps are worried about crime or something else. They've got all the doors shut, the windows shut, and either don't own an air conditioner or can't afford the electricity to run it. And so they jeopardize their health.
In hotter parts of the country, they already subsidize summer cooling bills for the poor, the way Pennsylvania does winter heating bills. With President Trump proposing to cut that program, Sweet says states and general ratepayers may end up paying more. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Scientists have linked fracking with health issues for people who live near gas wells. Many wonder whether the fracking process itself is to blame. But one researcher thinks the problem might have nothing to do with fracking, but rather something we see so often we hardly ever notice it. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explains as part of our series, Hazardous to Your Health.
Mike McCauley is a West Virginia University professor of environmental health. He studied the health effects of welding fumes, coal dust, and the volcanic ash from Mount St. Helens. When he started to study fracking a few years ago, he began hearing stories from residents and medical professionals in fracking areas of children getting asthma and an increase in cardiovascular disease.
That's usually considered a sentinel event when people start saying, well, I'm noticing this upswing. So it's not proof positive, but it's something to make you sit up and take a closer look.
These anecdotes were followed by studies showing similar trends, like an uptick in hospitalization, asthma, and premature birth in fracking areas. But these studies couldn't explain why these effects were happening. McCauley knew some of these symptoms were common in people exposed to diesel fumes. He thought these health impacts may be tied to diesel emissions at the well pad itself, from equipment used to drill and frack for natural gas. Then a few years ago, he had an epiphany, standing in a town in northeastern Pennsylvania during the height of the fracking boom.
And about every 45 seconds, there was a heavy-duty diesel truck came by, and it didn't matter what the time of day was.
Diesel engines emit a large number of tiny masses called ultrafine particles. These particles are so small they can fit inside the pores of a human cell, McCauley says. And once inside a cell, the particles can trigger a process called inflammation.
And inflammation generally tends to be the root cause of almost all disease. And one of the more notorious sets of diseases are developmental diseases in fetuses.
McCauley began testing the air along roads near fracking sites in West Virginia on a grant from the Department of Energy. and he saw concentrations of ultrafine particles similar to what you would find in a big city or near a highway. He says that makes sense since each gas well requires between 4 and 6,000 truck trips to haul equipment and material to a well site.
Here comes one.
In Scenery Hill, Washington County, Lois Bauer Bjornson can tell a truck coming up the road the next valley over. Bauer Bjornson and her husband moved to Washington County from Pittsburgh 13 years ago with their young children. She became an environmental activist after watching 33 wells get built within a 3-mile radius of her house. Trucks rumble by on the state highway she lives on. She knew the road had traffic when she moved in 13 years ago, but she said it wasn't like this.
When it was busy, it would be in the mornings and the evenings for like what we call rush hour, but not what it is now. It's endless, and you've got massive trucks, whether they're residual waste trucks, freshwater trucks, the crane trucks, just everything you need for a well pad is trucked in.
Now, the gas industry has tried to reduce truck traffic by piping more water into their well sites rather than using trucks. And it's converting some vehicles and equipment to run off natural gas instead of diesel. Still, diesel trucks remain indispensable for the industry. Some municipalities restrict the hours of truck traffic to well sites, and the State Department of Environmental Protection has limits on truck idling. The agency doesn't regulate truck travel for the fracking industry, or any other for that matter. The DEP does monitor air in drilling regions and says it's currently meeting federal standards. But those monitors it's using aren't measuring those ultrafine particles scientist Mike McCauley is so concerned about. Jim Fabizak is a public health scientist at the University of Pittsburgh. He says he isn't surprised McCauley thinks diesel trucks could be linked to health effects in fracking areas. He says diesel exhaust is a known carcinogen.
We also know that it contributes probably significantly to many of the other health endpoints we've attributed to air pollution, such as aggravating asthma, premature deaths from cardiovascular or respiratory disease.
McCauley says we could find public health impacts farther away from well pads than previously thought, though he says it's understandable that attention has been focused on well sites.
It's easy to make the blame game. If your kids are sick or your grandparents are sick or you're not feeling so well yourself, to say, ah, it must be that well pad because I can see that well pad and it's got its lights on all night long and we should be going after that. In fact, ignore the truck that's rumbling past your house.
Using satellite data and tissue samples of people who live near wells, McCauley is now testing his hypothesis that trucks are creating more risk to communities than previously thought. Those results could come out in the next year or two. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
That story is part of our series, Hazardous to Your Health, looking at pollution in Pittsburgh's communities. You can listen to more from the series at AlleghenyFront.org. On next week's show, we'll hear a story about how some kinds of chemicals are harder to filter from drinking water.
Each use of these chemicals should be thought out. Could we use a safer alternative for this use?
That's next week as our series on health continues. I'm Carol Holzapfel. This is the Allegheny Front. Since energy companies have been fracking gas wells, they've been trying to figure out the best way to deal with something called produced water. It's the roughly 200 barrels of chemical and mineral-laced water that gurgle out of a well every day while it produces natural gas. Several companies transport the wastewater from wells in Pennsylvania to sites in Ohio where it's injected thousands of feet into the ground and where it's been known to cause earthquakes. 90.5 WESA's Mark Neupbar reports that a new company in Mount Pleasant, Pennsylvania, thinks it can do better by building on an old technology.
Shyam DeGay, who once worked for Westinghouse and later ran his own industrial technology company, knew that any new technology to treat produced water had to beat out those injection wells.
What the competition is, the hole in the ground in Ohio, not GE or Halliburton. The drillers will take it to the cheapest disposal site. So with that in mind, three of us started this company, with a very laser focus that we have to beat the hole in the ground.
The gas company, Aquasource, has built a 70-barrel-a-day demonstration facility in Mount Pleasant, Pennsylvania. It takes produced water in at one end, and out the other comes distilled water and salt.
Salt could be of road salt grade, or could be of edible quality, because it's sodium chloride.
DeGay says he expects to have a 6,000-barrel-a-day production unit up and running in 6 to 8 months, followed by 20 to 30 units of that size or larger spread across the Marcellus Shale region. It operates on a simple concept. When water boils, it creates steam, which is pure water in gaseous form. Any impurities are left behind. In this case, that's table salt. So why have others not used their middle school science education to boil produced water and collect the salt? Because heating water through normal means, such as natural gas or coal, uses and wastes so much energy that it can't compete with a hole in the ground in Ohio. Aquasource instead heats the water using a plasma torch. A plasma torch is created by arcing a spark between two electrodes, much like a spark plug, and then using that spark to heat a stream of gas.
So just imagine this device is putting 10,000 spark plug energy into that gas. So the gas that comes out is at about 10,000 degrees centigrade. That gas is no different than the surface temperature of the sun.
The produced water is then sprayed into the path of that torch and vaporized. The secret is getting just the right mix of water and heat. Not enough water and you turn the salt into a glass-like substance. Too much water and you make brine. To make the process even more efficient, DeGay uses the energy released as the water cools to preheat the water about to be blown into the torch.
That's where we got our patents, because otherwise it's a very simple concept. So we will use only 1/5 the energy that is required theoretically to boil water.
The patented process also includes removing the chemicals originally added to the water to frack the well. In addition, it handles the radioactive material that sometimes comes up out of the ground with the water. When you combine the energy efficiency, the ability to sell the salt, and the lower cost of transporting the produced water from well to the disposal site, Aquasource thinks it can beat the price of the hole in the ground and do it in a more environmentally friendly way. DeGay says once it's perfected, he hopes to use the same technology to efficiently turn seawater into drinking water, and in a decade or so, maybe even shrink the process to a unit no bigger than a refrigerator that could purify water for poor villages around the world. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Mark Newtbar.
If someone says, oh, go jump in a lake, well, it's just not that easy in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania seems to be a water-rich state, and I'm curious as to why we don't have as many naturally occurring lakes as other states.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we dive to the bottom of this question. Here's a hint. Glaciers. Stay tuned. And I would never tell you to go jump in a lake. We know that President Trump wants to save coal mining jobs.
My administration is putting an end to the war on coal.
But think about this. Last year, the number of people working in the solar industry far exceeded those working in coal. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports about how Philadelphia is trying to take advantage of that trend.
Philadelphia has an ambitious plan. Create 10,000 green energy jobs in the next 10 years. The politicians behind this effort say it's a way to get residents with only a high school diploma a good job.
Up and down. Beautiful.
The city is aiming for people like 21-year-old Thomas Glenn, who right now is attaching a solar panel to a metal frame on a rooftop in Bryn Mawr, Delaware County. Several years ago, Glenn dropped out of high school and was living with his parents in the Kensington section of North Philadelphia.
You know, playing video games all day, listening to music. At the time, I was just waiting until I turned 18, and then I was going to become like a security guard or I was going to work at McDonald's.
Glenn says solar helped turn his life around. After getting his GED, he ended up in a training program for city youth that helped him get this job with a small solar company.
Well, the money's good. You get nice long hours. You're doing something good.
Glenn makes $15 an hour. Other more experienced crew members are making about $20 an hour. Still, that's only about half of what the average coal miner makes. But those coal jobs are disappearing while solar is growing.
You're up there, nice and safe. Let me see that rope for me, please.
And for high school grads in Philadelphia, $15 an hour is not such a bad starting wage. It's more than what Glenn could have made as a security guard or serving fast food. When I first heard about the push to create 10,000 green jobs, I was dubious. The city says the bulk of those jobs would come doing energy efficiency upgrades, not solar. But talk to solar installers these days, and they're bullish on the sun's energy.
Oh, absolutely. If we make the type of commitment to solar that we should, it's easy.
Micah Gold-Markell is Glenn's boss and the founder of Solar States, one of dozens of small solar installers working in the region. Standing on the rooftop deck of the Free Library of Philadelphia, Gold-Markell said his business has doubled in both revenue and employees in the last 3 years.
Look at the rooftops. There's so many out there that could take solar. That's our opportunity here.
Right now, Gold-Markell employs 23 people, and most of his business is in New Jersey, where the state has stronger incentives for rooftop solar. But he's also got business in the Philadelphia suburbs, and he expects it to double again next year. That's because the price of solar equipment has dropped significantly in the last 5 years.
It's huge. We've grown 100% the last 3 years running. I don't know if we can keep that up. It's it's causing me to get a lot of gray hair.
And while coal miners struggle to keep working, solar jobs in Pennsylvania grew 23% in 2016. PECO, the utility that provides electricity for Philadelphia and its suburbs, says the number of households wanting to install rooftop solar more than tripled between 2015 and 2016. In fact, the power company has created a new department and says it will hire 12 people just to keep up with the new solar requests. Nick DePatri owns the home in Delaware County where Glenn is installing solar panels. He says the election of Donald Trump motivated him and his wife to go solar. DePatri says they disagree with the current administration's promotion of fossil fuels, and they want to help the environment.
Even if you forget all those hippie motivations, it's a pretty good money move right now.
It's still not cheap. DePatri paid more than $18,000 up front for installation. But he says he'll get some of that back through a federal income tax credit. And he says from what he saves by not buying electricity, the solar panels will pay for themselves in 9 years, in part because he can sell extra energy back to the grid.
So during the day when you're producing most electricity, you're actually not using all of it. You can use some of it, but not all of it. And so what it does is it actually, there's a little box inside your house, it redirects the energy back out onto the wires, and it literally drives my neighbor's houses. It's like my house is a battery for the block.
As part of its 10,000 jobs goal, Philadelphia has a plan to get solar panels installed on 500 rooftops by the end of next year, which it says will create 75 jobs. A far cry from 10,000. But solar market experts say they expect the costs to keep dropping and solar installation jobs to keep growing.
Let's hold right there.
Down off the roof and on his lunch break, Thomas Glenn says at first it was scary working on top of houses.
I kind of got used to it. We developed something we call roof legs. You know, walking on the roof is just like walking on the ground to us now.
He says he expects to be working in solar for a long time, maybe even starting his own company one day. After all, there are a lot of rooftops out there. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
This week on the Trump on Earth podcast, what does pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement actually mean?
So basically, it's a very isolationist move.
The climate after Paris. This week on the Trump on Earth podcast. From the Allegheny Front and Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program on TrumpOnEarth.org.
President Trump's budget proposal is stark for the Great Lakes. He wants to slash the $300 million program created to clean them up, and that's gotten a lot of attention. But other parts of Trump's budget will also affect the region, including the National Sea Grant Program. Elizabeth Miller of Great Lakes Today has more.
3 months ago, Dr. Chris Winslow became director of Ohio Sea Grant after holding the position on an interim basis. He had big plans for the program, which focuses on science and education. But then the Trump administration released its budget blueprint for 2018, which cut all federal money for Sea Grant programs, including Ohio's.
I had an agenda of things that I was going to be doing over the next 3 or 4 months. That has slightly changed now. There's other things that have to be on there. So it changes, you know, my workload and what I'm addressing.
33 Sea Grant programs around the country are funded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Every coastal state has one, including the 8 bordering the Great Lakes. The programs have a 3-pronged approach: research, education, and outreach. And Winslow says he wants Ohio Sea Grant to be purposeful in its research.
I contact EPA, I contact the Department of Natural Resources, I contact agriculture, I contact health, and I say, hey, we're going to put another call out for research. You know, what's an issue that you would like to have a better handle on?
For Ohio Sea Grant, the major issue has been harmful algae blooms, the sometimes toxic algae overgrowth that can shut down beaches and threaten drinking water. Ohio Sea Grant has managed over 50 different projects focused on the blooms. They range from tracking blooms and studying water treatment to educating farmers about nutrient runoff. There's also been research on how harmful algae blooms affect people. Research assistant Alex Kwa blends head meat from a walleye, one of Lake Erie's most popular catches. He's on a team helping Ohio create fish consumption advisories based on microcystin, a toxin produced by blue-green algae. This walleye smoothie is the first step in a lengthy process to extract the toxin from the fish. Ohio State University professor Dr. Stuart Ludson leads the research team.
The state's been getting a lot of questions from anglers about whether it's safe to eat fish during the harmful algal bloom season, and so instead of just guessing, they wanted to obviously put some quantitative data to it.
Ludson's team found allowable levels of toxins in the muscle tissue of walleye and yellow perch. He says until further research is done, it's best to follow advisories already set for mercury levels in fish, 1 walleye a week and 2 perch a week. A couple of miles away, Dr. Ji Young Lee studies the effects of microcystin on lettuce, carrots, and green beans by irrigating the vegetables with toxin-contaminated water. Lee says the toxin affects shape and color of the vegetables, and a farmer's bottom line.
If the toxin microcystin is there, it definitely affects like a food safety, but also it really affects food quality and crop yield.
Trump's budget blueprint says NOAA programs like Sea Grant primarily benefit industry, state, and local stakeholders. His budget shifts more money to the military and for a wall along the Mexican border. The White House did not respond to a request for further comment, but Winslow says the Ohio Sea Grant program has a broad reach.
Anything we learn about harmful algal blooms, it's going to Florida. It's actually, I would argue, going to Iowa. And Iowa didn't have a Sea Grant program, but Iowa has ag and Iowa has harmful algal blooms.
Ohio's program has survived federal cuts before. It has a diversified revenue stream that includes the university, the state, and private donors. But while NOAA only provides 30% of the Ohio program's total budget, the federal government provides 100% of the research budget, which means some algae bloom studies wouldn't get done quickly or at all. Winslow plans to spend the next few months explaining to Congress how Ohio Sea Grant's research connects to the success of the state's economy and its tourism. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
Great Lakes Today is a collaboration of WBFO Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Rochester. According to the Erie Times-News, the $2 million federal budget of the Erie-based Pennsylvania Sea Grant program is also on the chopping block in Trump's proposed budget. The cuts could jeopardize future restoration projects and efforts to fight invasive species and the same toxic algae blooms the Ohio program is combating. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. Lake Erie is the 11th largest lake in the world, if you're going by surface area. The world's 117 million lakes come in all shapes and sizes, offering fresh water, beauty, commerce, and, of course, recreation. So one of our listeners wanted to know, what's the deal with the lack of natural lakes in Pennsylvania? For our occasional series, Citizen Q, where we answer your environmental questions, Margaret J. Krause found out.
Trillions of gallons of groundwater reside under the rocks and soil of Pennsylvania. It's a life-giving stockpile, annually replenished by some 42 inches of precipitation. So, Pittsburgh artist Travis Mitzel asked Citizen Q,
Pennsylvania seems to be a water-rich state, and I'm curious as to why we don't have as many naturally occurring lakes as other states.
Now, hang on a second, you might say to yourself. Pennsylvania has a lot of lakes. Maybe we're not Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes, and we're definitely in a different league than Alaska, with over 3 million. Touche, Alaska. But we're stacked, right?
It has more than some and fewer than many.
That's Milt Ostrovsky. He's a biology professor at Allegheny College in Meadville, Pennsylvania, where he teaches limnology, the study of lakes.
They typically say here in western Pennsylvania, we have 8 natural lakes. But we have more than that, depending on how small you want to go.
See, that's the tricky part about counting lakes, says Ostrovsky. No one really agrees on how to define a lake. A lake could be
a water body that flushes less than 10 times a year. Other states might say a lake is 10 acres or larger, or the lake has to be deep enough to thermally stratify, or cannot have weed growth throughout the entire basin, or
the list goes on.
I tell my class when I teach limnology that let's define a lake as simply a hole in the ground that's full of water.
By some estimates, there are 2,500 water-filled holes in the ground in Pennsylvania, but only a few of them aren't man or woman-made. If we're so water-rich, where's our abundance of unengineered natural lakes?
Glaciation is one of the primary processes that create lake basins.
The Wisconsin Glacier was coming and going in the northeastern and northwestern parts of Pennsylvania between 2 million and 12,000 years ago, but it didn't make it much past those areas.
So in the absence of glaciation, the central part of the state and all of the southern part of the state is millions of years old without any sort of disturbance.
Disturbance? Go on.
Pennsylvania has a fairly old landscape, and it's not tectonically active. We don't have lots of earthquakes causing the land to rise and sink and tilt.
That's Helen Delano, a senior geologic scientist at the Pennsylvania Geological Survey. Without tectonic activity making new depressions for water to gather, you don't get new lakes.
And lakes are short-lived features in terms of geologic time.
Lakes are kind of like that one neighbor's kiddie pool, with children getting in and out with grass and dirt on their feet. Given enough time, the grass would choke the pool. With lakes, sediment washes in with the rain, which accumulates, and turns it into a bog or swamp or marsh. Alternatively, water cuts a channel out of the lake and slowly drains over time, like when an overzealous kid bends the kiddie pool wall, spilling water all over the lawn.
So unless something happens to rejuvenate a lake, lakes don't tend to last very long.
In geologic time, not very long means we've got at least several thousand years to go. I went back to artist Travis Mitzel to blame geology for Pennsylvania's lack of lakes.
Okay, so that is, I guess, surprising.
What do you think? Do you feel like your question has been answered?
Oh, absolutely, because, you know, I have now learned that my state is just an old state and our lakes have moved on, and that's pretty cool. And it's just interesting to think about. Makes you think about the future and like what's going to be around and what's going to be entirely different.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
Thanks for listening to this week's show. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. All of the stories in our Hazardous to Your Health series looking at pollution in Pittsburgh's communities are at AlleghenyFront.org. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, and the Benedum Foundation. The Pittsburgh Foundation supports our series, Hazardous to Your Health, examining pollution in Pittsburgh's communities. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.